You are listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies and the Ellison Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/Ellison Center.
Hello. Welcome. I'm Scott Radnitz, the director of the Ellison Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies. It's hard to believe, but the full-scale invasion of Ukraine happened just about 2 years ago. A couple days from now will be the anniversary. We were all watching in shock when a column of Russian tanks was perched to invade Kyiv, and we've now all been exposed to the brutality that Russia has inflicted on Ukrainians from indiscriminate bombings and close-up violence. Yet over 2 years, much of the world has tuned out. Some governments that once enthusiastically supported Ukraine's fight for survival have had second thoughts. And some politicians, even in democracies, seem to be rooting for Russia. Even though the war is far from over, enough time has passed now that we're starting to see some new accounts that provide more details than the daily news coverage. Books that have been coming out since early 2022 promise to deliver something like a first draft of history. But I've seen some of these books, and they can come with agendas, or are written by people who don't really know what they're talking about, and especially by people who have not been on the ground in Ukraine. The book we'll hear about tonight, The War Came to Us, is not one of those. Its author, Christopher Miller, has been reporting from Ukraine since 2010 and has worked for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, BuzzFeed News, Politico, and now the Financial Times. You might have also seen him on BBC, NPR, or the CBC, or writing commentary for The Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, CNN, Vice News, and other outlets. He started in Ukraine as a Peace Corps volunteer in Bakhmut. A word about the Ukraine beat. It's often the case that whether a professor or a reporter, you develop expertise in a particular place and produce great work, but in relative obscurity for many years. You remain devoted to the place, maybe Ukraine, because you find it intellectually stimulating, or you like the people or culture or the food or something about it. But most people have limited attention spans and a poor grasp of geography and don't care about what happens there. Until something happens that draws the world's attention, and suddenly overnight, people want to know everything about it. And you happen to be one of the few people who was there all along and can communicate what the world wants to know. The War Came to Us is, according to its publisher, the definitive inside story of Ukraine's long fight for freedom. It is told through Miller's personal experiences, vivid frontline dispatches, and illuminating interviews with unforgettable characters. It has also received rave reviews from critics, and incidentally is for sale in the back of the room after the talk. And you might even be able to get an autograph. Before we start, I want to acknowledge the generous support of the Henry M. Jackson Foundation, without which tonight would not be possible. And now, please join me in welcoming Christopher Miller.
You're good? Okay. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I was just saying it's always a bit strange for me being on this side of the microphone. I'm usually on your side asking the questions, watching the presenter. Let me just find this slide here. Okay. Look, I'm just a lowly reporter, not a tech guy. Okay, great. Yeah, that sounds like a good place to start. I will talk at you for a little while and tell you, I was going to say a little, but honestly a lot, about my experience of the last 10 years. Some of you I know have followed my progress and work very closely. It's very nice to see some of you who I've known for many years and remember from my Peace Corps days, 14 years ago now? Like any good story, I'm just going to start from the beginning. That's where the book begins. It's you know, in the beginning, in this case, I guess is, you know, before Ukraine was a country at war. So as Scott mentioned, I've been in Ukraine for 14 years. I arrived in the country in spring of 2014. I think it was late March or early April when we arrived in Kyiv. Had not set out to be a reporter in Ukraine. I joined the Peace Corps looking for a foreign adventure. Like all of you, I'm a Pacific Northwesterner. I grew up in Portland, just down the road. And, you know, this was a brand new place for me. It was strange. It was fascinating. I thought that I would go off and have this, you know, fun adventure for 2 years, return to Portland, and sort of just get on with my life. What I did not think would happen was, you know, 14 years later, I'd be standing up and talking to you about a war in the country. So I arrived at a really interesting time, and that was 2010. I feel like you are probably all pretty well versed in Ukraine's politics and know a bit, enough about the country. I can maybe name drop some Ukrainian politicians, like Viktor Yanukovych, the former president who fled to Russia and was ousted. Okay, so Viktor Yanukovych rigged an election in 2004, and this is what prompted the Orange Revolution. He was legitimately elected later in 2010 and became president of the country just about 2 months before I arrived in Ukraine. So I entered Ukraine at this moment when the country was actually quite divided, very much between East and West. There was a lot of democratically minded, European minded people who supported the former president, Viktor Yushchenko, whose side won the Orange Revolution. He became president. And then there were a lot of people who supported Yanukovych and felt as though he better represented them politically. Those people largely being from the geographically from the south, from the east, those places where Russia had great influence, where Russian was the predominant language spoken. And that's where I ended up, or was sent by the Peace Corps, eastern Ukraine, in a city called Artyomovsk. This was the Soviet given name of the city. This was the sign that stood at the entrance, the western entrance of the city, for decades, until it was removed during a period of communization in 2016, and the city was renamed its historical name was returned, that being Bakhmut. So you've probably heard of Bakhmut in the last couple of years, being this place where Russian forces pushed in, destroyed the city, occupied it, now are in control of it. But before it became the location of, or the site of, arguably the most brutal battle of this this war, it was a very peaceful city of 70,000 people, and that's where our story begins. I arrived there late in the spring of 2010. I found it looking a bit like this. This is a monument that stood at the entrance of the city that always sort of mark, you know, you knew when you were arriving in Bakhmut when you would see this fighter jet on its kind of strange pedestal there. It became a symbol of Ukraine's defense of the city last year until it was destroyed by a Russian missile. But it was, I'm just going to show you a bunch of slides as a way of, you know, sort of taking you through the journey that follows very much the timeline of the book and also of events here. This was the center of town. A lot of eastern Ukrainian cities and provincial Ukrainian cities looked very similar to this. It was a mix of, pre-Russian Revolution architecture, of Soviet architecture, some modern architecture. Again, this was a city of about 70,000 people. They went about their business just like a lot of people in the suburbs of Seattle went about their business, right? Working at schools, local tech companies, furniture companies. They were taxi drivers, teachers. I became a teacher myself, working at a school, or a couple of schools rather, for the Peace Corps. It hummed along. This was a big shopping center here called Silpo. It was a popular, still is a popular grocery chain throughout the country here. I'm showing you these because the photos that I'll show you later will give you a sense of the destruction, and you know, we'll show you just how empty the city is now. I mean, there is no, it is now devoid of life, as are many other cities that Russia has come to quote unquote liberate, right? But this was a busy city. I did all of my shopping in the either the supermarket chain or this market that's straight in the back, kind of where all these cars and people are funneling to. I would practice my Russian back there, practice some of my still rough Ukrainian. I got to know a lot of the city and the people through my daily interactions. So this location was really important for my own kind of education and building the foundation of understanding, cultural understanding, language with people in Bakhmut at the time. These are just a few more photos that show you a little bit more of the sort of life and atmosphere. The top right corner is the fountain in the city's main square and the city hall building. Later it would be completely flattened last year, but before then I got to know the mayor of the city. He would invite me in for cigars and something a little bit stronger than coffee every once in a while when he was bored and felt like he you know, needed to have a chat with his favorite and only American in town. One of my friends, who's mentioned as a character in the book, worked there as part of the local elections department. And again, there wasn't a whole lot to do in non-election years, so we would have beers and practice my Russian. I got this, you know, sort of history lesson on a pretty regular basis from him and others who were interested in getting to know me and speaking with the only Western foreigner in town at the time. It became this sort of informal club that we had, and again, it formed, you know, the basis of my understanding of the country and allowed me really to learn about the complexities of this place that I think, you know, I came, well, I think is often misunderstood and misspoken about. You know, I didn't come into this experience as a Peace Corps volunteer with many preconceived notions. I was very open-minded. Part of the reason for that was really I didn't set out to come to Ukraine, right? So everything was new and fascinating and interesting, and I made this rule for myself that I would not say no to anything, with few exceptions. I would always say yes and accept every invitation, thinking that it might lead to something fascinating, something new, and help me to better understand the country. So real quick before I move on, the square to the left is the same square but just sort of a mirror image, and the guy standing with his hand out was Comrade Artyom, Sergei Fyodorov. He was a Russian, well, a Bolshevik hero, Russian revolutionary, close to Stalin. He died in a really magnificent way on this jet-propelled train that the Soviet Union was trying to create. Stalin adopted his child, made Artyom this national hero, and they put up these monuments all over the Soviet Union to Artyom, and they named several cities and villages after him. So this Bakhmut was renamed Artyomovsk. There were several villages called Artyomovsky or other variations of his name. Later in 2016, the Ukrainian government ripped down Artyom, took him off his pedestal, which is this photo down here, threw him in a dump site, as well as all the other smaller ones. They did the same with Lenin, who is here. He was on the square just opposite, and you know, Lenin, many people at the time still felt that Lenin was a very important figure, especially people in Eastern Ukraine. The opinion was very different in Western Ukraine, and for many in Kiev. But in Eastern Ukraine, people would still show up, and as you can see, they would lay out flowers on the monument to him on his birthday and on important Soviet holidays. Just an example of how, you know, many people were still nostalgic for the Soviet Union and communism. Over time, though, and during the decommunization period in 2016, he also came down and was put into a dump site. I don't know where he ended up, but he may have still been there when the Russians came in. Anyway, his head also didn't make it. These are just more images of the center of the city, just to give you a sense of what it was like. This was during one of the May Day holidays. People would walk around with glasses of champagne from the local wineries. Artyomovsk or Bakhmut was known for mining salt and also producing sparkling wine. And the fun fact about the sparkling wine factory is it was actually ordered to be created by Stalin. And opened on his birthday with this great ceremony. It's still the company is still around, and they're called Art Winery now rather than Artyomovsk Winery. Also because of decommunization in the country, but unfortunately the wine plant itself was created in this alabaster mine and. Is in the occupied territory of Bakhmut at the moment. The last time I saw photographs of it was when the Russian warlord Yevgeny Prigozhin and his Wagner mercenaries had used it as a sort of base because it was underground last year. Again, more photos of just life in the city, giving you the sense of, you know, what it was like. Oftentimes I would get invited to these city events to speak a few words about the city. The mayor would call me up and say, look, we have this really important event. You know, some people from Donetsk, you know, the regional government are coming, or we have a very important guest from Kiev. Would you come and speak about, you know, just how much you love our city and how great we are? And I would say, you know, absolutely. So I would show up and as the sort of, you know, the token American to show that, you know, Artyomovsk was this city that could even sustain American life. These are just some of the photos from the market where I practiced my Russian, and I know it was very similar to a lot of my my colleagues in the Peace Corps. You know, we spent a lot of time at the markets and got to know, you know, the people who worked them, and I, you know, so much of what I've learned about Ukraine has come from, you know, ordinary people who work regular jobs, who are, you know, who were very apolitical, you know, not really for Russia or against Russia, not really for, you know, Yanukovych or against him. I think what's important to understand is in this period of time before the war broke out, you know, people were largely apolitical. You know, they were not pro-Russian in the sense, I think, that a lot of people would paint them, or a lot of reporters even would paint them to be. You know, pro-Russian, I think, around this period of time, as I understood it and was told by a lot of my friends, was really, you know, they had close ties to family just across the border. Bakhmut was just 2 or 3 hours from the Russian border. It was very easy to get there by car or by bus or by train. There was a lot of business done across the border. Is just because of, you know, proximity, a lot of them were, you know, viewed Russia positively or friendly. But it doesn't mean that they were pro-Putin or agreed with the Kremlin. They just had this strong regional identity, mostly wanted to be left alone. You know, did not want to be heavily influenced by Moscow or Kiev at that period of time. These are inside of the winery on the bottom right here. It shows you a little bit. You can kind of see like the colored walls. This is an alabaster mine again, and to keep the workers happy who worked, you know, 8 hours a day underground, they painted the walls of the mine like rainbow colors, so they'd be like fluorescent pink, green, blue, and they said this kept the workers happy. I said I thought maybe the wine kept the workers happy, and the director insisted that they don't drink on the job. But as you can see, we did plenty of that on my visits, and every once in a while they would call me to say, we have some foreigners visiting, they don't speak Russian or Ukrainian, just English, could you translate and help us out? And I then would go on yet another tour of the winery and have to also, you know, forced to taste the wine with them at the end. The left is this salt mine that's about 1,000 feet underground in a nearby town called Soledar. It was not only really important economically for eastern Ukraine, as was all mining, but it was rare in the sense that it was the only salt mine in the region. A lot of the mine a lot of the mine work in eastern Ukraine was coal, and so a lot of the cities were coal dusted, quite literally. You know, you could go out to your car in the morning and rub your finger across the hood, and you know, you'd get a bunch of coal. A lot of people develop, you know, respiratory problems, but yet in Artyomovsk, the city was kept very clean because there were no coal mines too close by. And actually, people with respiratory problems from mining or living in other coal mining cities would come to Artyomovsk and Soledar to go down into the salt mine, where they had a spelio sanatorium, or this place where you could relax for hours or days, even sleeping in like some sleeping quarters down there, because they believed it was good for your respiratory system. So I spent a few days down there on different occasions, just meeting and talking with the miners and the people who ran the mine. And then one kind of cool thing that they used to do before the war is once a year in October, they would invite all of Ukraine's political elite to what they called a salt symphony. And it was an orchestra that they would have in the largest kind of portion of this mine. It was so big, it was the size of an airplane hangar, and they would play classical music for hours on end, and they would bring everybody down in this open elevator that took about 3 minutes to get all the way down. It was a bit spooky. So, you know, a big part of my education happened at school. This is where I worked. It's the Krasny Village School. It's since been renamed the Ivanovsky Village School, again, because of decommunization, Krasny meaning red, so it was named, you know, red after the Red Army, a very Soviet name. So eventually it was given, after 2014, the name of Ivanovsky. I worked here for 2 years. I taught various lessons. If you've read the book, you know that some of those went fairly well, some did not. But it, again, was a place that where I think I learned just as much, if not more, than the people I was meant to be teaching. I practiced my Russian there. I really got you know, a glimpse into the educational system there. I learned a lot about people's lives, and they really let me in. And many of the people who I met at this school, I'm still in contact with, including one of the main characters in the book, Nikolai Georgievich, who's now an older man and lives in Germany. And I'm very happy that he is, because this school and much of the village has since been destroyed as well. And I didn't include a photo of it destroyed, but it has been almost completely flattened. On the left there, that's me during a birthday celebration. Nikolai is the older gentleman on the right, and the school director is just to his left. This is one of the men's day competitions. So there still was, and so I say men's day. This was a Soviet holiday that carried over for years until recently in Ukraine. You know, this being a small village in far eastern Ukraine, close to the Russian border, they still celebrated a lot of the holidays that were popular and celebrated in Soviet times. This day has since been renamed the Day of Defenders, or Defenders Day, and moved to a different date to separate itself from the day that Russia celebrates it. But this was one of the competitions of all the boys, I think in 8th, 9th, 10th form classes. For some reason the winner was given a parrot. That's why you've got the blue and yellow patriotic bird there. But these are the kinds of things that I was involved in. You know, I was a judge here. Besides being a teacher, you know, they would always say, well, it's important that we get the American perspective here, so he has to judge, right? Because all the other teachers had their favorites, so I was seen as the impartial judge. This is just me teaching in one of the classes. One thing that you would always see in every classroom, whether it's Western Ukraine or Eastern Ukraine, in the South, North, in Kiev, is a portrait of Ukraine's national poet Taras Shevchenko, who's hanging just above the chalkboard there. There are also monuments of him all across the country, including in central Kiev, in front of his namesake university, Taras Shevchenko National University. It's the beautiful red columned building. If you've ever seen photos of central Kiev or been fortunate enough to visit, you will absolutely remember and recognize this building. And then just a graduation ceremony for some of the the younger students there at the end of the school year. I was talking about it being a mining region. It was also a heavily industrialized region with signs of progress, signs of you know, its rougher past. You know, something that I talk about in the book is that, you know, while viewed as being pro-Russian and predominantly Russian-speaking, you know, the reasons for those things existing is because Russia came in and really Russified the east of Ukraine. It was a Ukrainian-speaking area with ethnic, predominantly of ethnic Ukrainians, you know, before the Soviet Union. Then during the sort of industrialization period, Russia brought in people to work the factories, to Russify the area. They brought in, of course, that means, of course, they brought in people who spoke Russian. A lot of the Ukrainians sort of disappeared. I found people speaking Ukrainian on the outskirts of the city. So in small villages, people did still speak Ukrainian. There was this really gorgeous little village called Zvanivka, where I met people who had actually moved from Western Ukraine to escape the Nazi invasion. To find themselves in this area and set up this little town where most people didn't actually understand Russian, yet they existed in this now Russian-speaking place. So, you know, one of the reasons I included the photo of the destroyed building on the left, which has nothing to do with the war, this is what it looked like in 2010, is because it was actually the administration building for the largest glass-producing factory in the Soviet Union. It was in a town called Konstantinovka, or in Ukrainian, Kostiantinovka. The text at the top says, "Nasha tsel komunizm," which means, "Our goal is communism." And I just thought it was quite symbolic, given the fact that it was completely hollowed out and looked like it had been bombed, yet this was 2010. But back in Soviet times, this town of Konstantinovka had something like 20 to 23, 24 factories. Today, because of the war, none of them are working, but even when I arrived there in 2010, I think there were only three or four working factories. This was not one of them. There was another building just adjacent to it that had more text scrawled across it that said, "Idea Lenina bessmertny," like the ideas of Lenin are immortal, but it was also in disarray, proving again that you know, this idea was actually mortal. But it produced the red glass that the Kremlin uses for its stars on top of its towers there. So it was quite famous. But the town had been in disarray because of a lack of investment after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you know, it was a pretty rough place. The photo up here is the Avdiivka coke plant. It's important. It was important economically because it helped power the east, particularly the city of Donetsk. All of the coal produced in the region would go to this factory to produce, you know, more coke to power more plants. It was just destroyed last week and captured by Russian forces. So I thought it kind of timely to include. But it was this hulking mammoth factory in a region filled with several impressive factories, including those that you've probably heard of down in Mariupol, like Azovstal and whatnot. But I just wanted to show also that it was a really beautiful region. You could go swimming in the Siversky Donets River. There were these beautiful monasteries on the hillside. It was a heavily forested area. So it wasn't just, you know, dark and grim and flat and filled with coal. It was, you know, very much a beautiful region. Now very much war-torn. And even this monastery on the hill, which is in a town called... Sverokorsk, or Sverohirsk in Ukrainian, has been badly damaged because of the war. This is just a taxi that I took a ride in a few times, and I did survive. Again, just some of the coal mining. So there is a bit in the book. I thought it interesting and important to really show the culture and talking about the local economy to write about some of these guys that I spent some time with. So. This is a group of miners working in a coal mine in the town of Torez, and not a legal coal mine. So these are called kopanki. They're illegal coal mines. In this area of eastern Ukraine, coal is like surface level. You can take a shovel and people would just scoop coal out of their backyard and use it for the furnaces. Sometimes you have to go a little bit deeper. This opening here went down about a football field deep into the ground, and they would lower themselves in there with a little car, an old like 30, 40-year-old car engine. If you're familiar with the old Lada models that the Soviets made, that's what they used. They would hook that up to a winch, get inside of a bathtub, and then lower themselves down in there. I went about 20 feet before I started screaming and told them, bring me out. And the reason for that was just a few moments earlier, well, besides it being dark and getting narrower and narrower as I went down, what they had told me prior to that was, one of their other miners had just been killed about a month ago from methane poisoning. It was really difficult to get him out, and they explained what they did after that happened. These were men that made very, very little money. This was a really, really hard life. They had very few options in a town like Terez, and so this is what they did to survive. They mined, they took this coal that they mined illegally, sold it to Viktor Yanukovych's family, who operated the legal mines and the state-supported mines. They would take this and put it in with the other legal mines and then sort of cook the books and say that, these state mines were actually producing a lot more than they really did. To keep these things open, though, it they had to pay off police, they had to pay off Yanukovych's family. It was kind of this, like a local mafia, and they really actually referred to them as the family. But what happened when someone would die in these mines is they would take them, clean them up, take them to a local creek or a river, submerge them in water, pump their chests, and try to get water into their lungs so that they could go report to the police that their friend had become drunk and drowned by accident. And this way, their family could receive whatever kind of pension this person had or insurance. If they had found that they were in the mine and died there, the families would not receive those things, and the mine would be shut down. So this was the sort of agreement that they had to keep them open. So this is what they told me before they started lowering me down there. Luckily, I realized that was a bad idea and had them pull me out. After the Peace Corps, I finished in late spring of 2012 and moved to Kiev shortly after that. The capital is really a beautiful place. There were still lots of signs of, its communist past. This arch here, which still stands in Kiev, is known as the People's Friendship Arch, and it was made in the 80s and partnered with the statue in the center there, which is meant to show a Russian and Ukrainian standing, essentially hand in hand, saying that, we're brother nations. That was just recently taken down. But this idea of brother nations, which existed for a long time after Ukraine's independence, was something that kind of lingered for decades, even though many Ukrainians no longer saw themselves as brothers with Russia, until finally, after the invasion and Russia's war against the country, they're like, look, we're no longer brothers. Like, brothers don't do this to each other. They've since taken that down. And actually put a symbolic crack in the top of the arch. I think it's just a decal, not a real structural crack. And then this just gives you a sort of night view of Krasiatyk Street. Before the war, they would often, on the weekends, close it down to just foot traffic. And everybody would go out in the summertime and even sit on the street and drink and chat or eat. And it's filled with lights and cafes. And even though these structures were built in Soviet time, they are really stunning. And the interesting thing is they're meant to look, and they do look, decades, if not a couple centuries old or something. But actually, all of this street was destroyed in the Second World War. The Russians, the Red Army, destroyed all of central Kiev around Krasiatyk Street when the Nazis occupied the capital. And so these are relatively new, but interestingly, have also come under attack by Russia yet again. This is just, I wanted to show you that, there is this sort of political life in Kiev that has always been very vibrant. This is the former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko in a demonstration that I stumbled upon back in 2012 when she was jailed by Viktor Yanukovych. These are a couple of women, or a few women here, arguing about whether or not she should be in prison. One of them was a Yanukovych supporter. One of them was from Western Ukraine and arguing that she should, of course, be set free. This is in Donetsk when Yanukovych was president, and actually when Dmitry Medvedev was president during Putin's short break. I had an opportunity to go to this event, which was an economic summit in Donetsk, with all of these oligarchs. This is Ukraine's richest man, Rina Akhmetov, on the left. This is Viktor Pinchuk, and then a whole table of governors and oligarchs and all of Ukraine's political elite. Really, where I, you know, this is my first kind of like brush with all of these people, and later I would interview many of them or be declined interviews by many of them. But this was my first real moment to sort of confront them, ask them questions, see how they carried themselves. And I remember feeling very, very out of place, but you know, really interested in the local politics there. So, okay, I'll fast forward now to you know, the things that sort of brought us to where we are today. In 2013, I had been working in Kyiv as a correspondent already for nearly a year when you know, these protests happened on Kyiv's Maidan Nezalezhnosti, or Independence Square. You know, we didn't necessarily see these protests coming. And in fact, they were at first just a reaction or response to Viktor Yanukovych's decision to not take the country westward and sign this association agreement with the European Union, but rather to turn to Russia for a financial bailout, essentially keeping Ukraine within its Russia's sphere of influence. So you get a bunch of demonstrators, predominantly kids, university students, in the first couple of weeks, turning out to protest Yanukovych's decision peacefully. And this is why it was called the Euromaidan protests at first, before it became an uprising or the revolution of dignity as we know it now. It really, you know, I think in the first, even in the first couple of weeks, it wasn't certain that these protests would resonate beyond Kyiv or beyond a lot of the students and sort of like intelligentsia that first turned out. In fact, I remember writing a story with a Ukrainian colleague of mine where we questioned whether or not this street movement could continue, and what would happen if they moved from the street elsewhere, and how you know, whether there was any chance of keeping up the momentum. And then what happened was the pro-Russian government at the time ordered the riot police to attack these peaceful students on the square, and I was there that night. I had sort of accidentally, not knowing that this was going to happen, I had gone out that evening to see how many people were out. I was curious again to see whether or not these protests would continue, and then, you know, these black riot police in black, well, black uniforms, black helmets, you know, clubs in hand, came out and sort of, you know, very slowly and ominously, like, formed a ring around these protesters, you know, started closing that ring very slowly and then attacked them. This really shook much of the country, and that's what led to the response in the next day and the next days to come. You see people in the second photo here wearing bicycle helmets and motorcycle helmets and masks, because, you know, what happened afterward was a much more violent scene. Mass protests, tens of thousands of people, and then hundreds of thousands of people. It was one of the most remarkable things I'd ever experienced. And at that point, you know, I had not set out to be a war correspondent or a crisis reporter or anything of that sort. I was interested in Ukraine because I was fascinated with the place at that time. And you know, here I was now in the midst of a major uprising and sort of finding my way, as a lot of these protesters were doing the same. So I would follow many of them over the course of the next 3 months as they trained with various, you know, sort of handmade weapons to defend themselves against repeated attacks by riot police. Eventually, it would escalate further and become deadly in January. These are some of the photos, I think, from January, maybe one from February on the bottom left there. But you know, the response from people, and I think what we've also seen the last couple of years is this really incredible mobilization of Ukrainian society. I've just continually been impressed by Ukrainians' ability to mobilize quickly, to unite even segments of society that had no business, with another part of society who would disagree politically on things or on other social matters, would come out and unite against this common foe. That common foe at this point being state-sponsored violence, state violence, Yanukovych's decision to take the country, back toward Russia. And so what you're seeing in this top right photo is a group of people, some football hooligans, soccer fans, with some older pensioners, putting together Molotov cocktails to throw at the riot police during one of the protests there. So eventually, I mean, I'm sure many of you have seen, the documentary about Euromaidan. You've seen a lot of the photos from the protests there. It was as intense as it looked, even more so. And eventually, dozens of people, more than 100 people, would be killed. The photo on the left is during a standoff with riot police on Grushevskoye Street, which is a street that leads up to the Cabinet of Ministers and the Parliament building. On the right, this was February 20th, so almost exactly 10 years ago, yesterday. This is a protester leaning over the body of a man who had just been killed by a riot police officer. The reason I took this photo is because I saw this man shot and killed, and I helped carry him down from Institutska Street to a medical tent, where the color from his face just disappeared as he bled out, and there was nothing the medics there could do. But he was wearing this black vest, which still wasn't thick enough to protect him. And he was shot twice in the back while he was turning around, shouting at some of his fellow protesters to rush forward, to move toward police lines, and it penetrated the vest twice. He collapsed and was one of the first that was killed on February 20th. And I think around 70 people were shot dead on that day by the riot police. Eventually there would be, this is three bodies here, but there would be, 10 or 11 lined up here, and then in three or four other locations, the scene was very similar. And I spent most of that day not only reporting on the back and forth, the fighting, the clashing between the protesters and police, but making my rounds to, four different points where the medics on the square were placing the bodies and laying them out as they accumulated. I remember having to tally them up, which is one of the grimmest things I had to do at that point. It was a tally that just kept increasing. And I think by that night I was already, well over 40 or 50, including, more than a dozen inside of the landmark Hotel Ukraina or Hotel Ukraine on the square there. These are just some more images of that day. It was just filled with smoke. You couldn't breathe. We had to wear masks. We were constantly coughing. I remember, and something I mentioned in the book is that you could tell who had been on the square because we could never get the smell of smoke out of our clothes, out of our hair, out of our skin. Those of us who were there every day, day in and day out, we had this like film on our hands and arms and face. And no matter how many times I shower or whatever I scrubbed with, it would just not come off. And eventually it sort of became this kind of badge of honor, and people would, go around kind of commenting on it. Or one of my friends would say, your hair's not black enough. If they thought that you hadn't spent enough time on the square. This is what it looked like toward the end of February 20th. Mid-morning, I guess, February 20th. It felt like a long day. But by midday, Some of the police had broken through Ukrainian protesters' lines, and they were busy reinforcing those lines. And so what you see down at the bottom, in the middle of the street, you can kind of see a couple of guys carrying tires, and then this kind of human chain where they were taking tires and bricks, paving stones from the road and passing them forward to create these large barriers to stop the police from attacking again. This obviously, the Euromaidan ended on February 20th, February 21st, 22nd, after Viktor Yanukovych fled to Russia. Ukraine's parliament would quickly vote to oust him, saying that he had abandoned his duties as president. I think that's also something that we kind of don't fully understand or misrepresent, even those of us in the media sometimes. We use words like, Viktor Yanukovych was ousted or overthrown. In reality, he fled himself to Russia, and then Ukraine's parliament voted to dismiss him as president. An interim president was appointed, and protesters moved from the square to Viktor Yanukovych's palatial estate, which was the most impressive and absurd thing I have ever seen in my life, probably. It's this compound, this heavily gated and guarded compound about the size of Monaco, where he had a golf course, ostriches, all kinds of exotic animals, and then the worst taste in interior design you could possibly imagine, including golden toilets and golden accented things like, loaves of bread, encrusted in gold. And it's since become the State Museum of Corruption. But when I was there, Ukrainians were jumping the fence, breaking open the gates. They were actually very respectful. Like, nobody was stealing anything. All of the protesters were like telling each other, like, don't ruin anything, don't take anything. I just thought that was really remarkable, because in that moment there was so much chaos and they were so high on adrenaline and the fact that they had, done what they had set out to do, which was, dismiss this president, force him away. And yet they were extremely respectful and knew, what this place stood for. And we're very, aware of the fact that them stealing from this place could look like, they would in turn be doing something that he had done to them, right? But they didn't get to celebrate very long, because on February 20th, Russia set into motion its annexation of Crimea. So within days, the jubilant atmosphere and mood in Kyiv was quickly overtaken by this feeling of uncertainty. And the images of unmarked Russian soldiers fanning out over the peninsula of Crimea. These are two Ukrainian soldiers at a military base outside of Simferopol, the Crimean capital. So I immediately went from Independence Square in Kyiv on a plane to Crimea just a couple of days later, without much rest myself, to find this other really peculiar situation unfolding, and again, a lot of uncertainty. I found a Ukrainian military that was weak, demoralized, unsure of who to take orders from. Many decided to defect and join the Russian side. Being Crimea, with a lot of pro-Russian sentiments and Russian speakers, there were people who were ready to go to the Russian side, and they did. This is some of the moments, tense moments of a standoff between Russian soldiers and Ukrainian soldiers at the Belvec Air Base. There, just a few days after I arrived, these soldiers on the right were calling their girlfriends and their wives and saying that they were okay. In reality, all around us were a bunch of Russian snipers and special forces with their rifles trained on each of us. You can kind of see some of the vehicles in the background on the photo on the left. This is Yuli Mamchur in the bottom left in the cap. He was this incredibly brave Ukrainian commander of this Air Force unit there, who told his men to put down all their arms and walk unarmed toward these Russians, where they were going to demand that they stand down and leave the peninsula. Of course, they did not, but this it won him a lot of plaudits and respect. He was one of the early heroes of Ukraine's defense against Russia's invasion. Cool. Okay. I realize I'm talking a lot about kind of the older stuff. I'll speed up a little bit. You know, these are just some images of the Russians in their unmarked uniforms. They were called Little Green Men. You know, shortly after the annexation, which happened almost without firing a weapon, we saw Russia's first military invasion of mainland Ukraine. You know, so I went back to what were my old stomping grounds and immediately tried to figure out how people were feeling, who was taking up arms for Ukraine, who was, you know, taking up arms on the other side. And I found a lot of my sort of community of friends and acquaintances in eastern Ukraine were very divided. My Russian language tutor had taken the Russian position and was, you know, suddenly unwilling to speak with me, and you know, again accusing me of being a spy and, you know, trying to impose my will on them because I was an American and supporting Kiev and overthrowing Yanukovych, etc. These are images I just wanted to show because this is kind of how the sort of fake Russian uprising began in eastern Ukraine. There was a lot of Russian propaganda that this was a U.S.-sponsored extension of the, you know, coup that happened in Kiev, quote-unquote. You know, it actually did work in Donetsk region and Lugansk region, and a lot of people, you know, really did take up arms and fight their own people in those areas. In Kharkiv, however, which is the photo on the left, there were these pro-Russian protests that were, you know, pushed by Russian special services and kind of secret operators, but it didn't really catch on. And we see today that Kharkiv has remained under Ukrainian control, although it's being bombarded very heavily by Russian missiles at the moment. This is the regional government building in central Donetsk. That was an absolutely terrifying place to enter. It was just filled with warlords, you know, carrying around guns with their safeties off and shooting people in the foot by accident and that sort of thing. But it was heavily guarded, and we would have to go in there as journalists to ask for accreditation to operate in the city so that we wouldn't be arrested. Some of us were detained several times anyway, and then, you know, put into these sort of makeshift cages inside this building for several hours and scolded and told to write the truth, which, if you've read the book, was something that I heard a lot in Russian, «Пишите правду, пишите правду», and so much so that I got it tattooed on me as a way of sort of getting it out of my head and putting it someplace else, but also as a reminder of you know, where I'd been and what I had done. This is some of the propaganda that was very powerful, that worked on a population that was nostalgic for some of the, you know, quote-unquote good old days of Soviet times. So up here, it's, you know, it's a Russian propaganda poster that says, you know, stand up and fight for the People's Army of the Donetsk People's Republic. And it's an image that is likening the 2014 war to the Patriotic War of 1941, the Second World War, and the Bolshevik Revolution in 1918. Down below is just a poster saying, you know, defend the Republic, with a bunch of numbers you could call to join the fight. But Ukraine's response, you know, the people who were the protesters during the Euromaidan Revolution became its soldiers. Ukraine didn't have a strong army at that time. As I mentioned in the book, the acting president, Oleksandr Turchinov, explained to me we only had 5,000 to 6,000 trained soldiers, and you know, we couldn't respond with so few. So the people who became the fighters and defenders were the Maidan revolutionaries, who just a few weeks or a few months earlier were, you know, using bats against the police force, and now they were handling automatic weapons, or in the case of some scrappy guys, their hunting rifles and shotguns. So this, I had embedded with this group that didn't have a name at the time. They were just they kind of called themselves the Black Men, and they wore these, you know, face masks, balaclavas, and all black uniforms. Eventually, they would call themselves the Donbas Battalion, taking the word from the region to name their battalion. And I spent a lot of time with them as they would sort of storm into these police stations where the police commander was pro-Russian. He had ordered his men to sort of crack down on dissenters. It was a very, very strange moment, and we found ourselves in the middle of forests oftentimes, where I took this photo. Eventually, Ukraine's military would get its act together, would set up these checkpoints. This is one of them between the cities of Slavyansk and Krematorsk on the left. I was being stopped and questioned and just asked to show my identification as a journalist and to sort of explain what I was doing. They let me take this photo while one of the commanders was checking my documents. On the right, this was the Russian military response. So after, you know, what Russia did in 2014 was very different than what it did in 2022. This is like an explicit Russian invasion happening, right? Putin went on TV and said, we're invading Ukraine, and he gave a bunch of BS bogus reasons for doing so. In 2014, he did not admit to that, right? He sent in these unmarked troops to annex Crimea. He did the same in eastern Ukraine. These were some of them. These guys would tell me that they're local. I could tell by their accents that they were not local. Some of them were from the Caucasus, some of them were from Moscow. They couldn't tell you what any city outside of Donetsk was even called. They, you know, would ask us for directions on the road. How do you get, you know, from here to here? And I would say, well, aren't you from here? And they say, yeah, we're, you know, just around the corner. I'm like, well, then you would know how to get from here to here. But they came in by the truckload across the border through these open fields and then eventually to Donetsk, Slavyansk, all these other cities where they would, you know, then fan out and sort of embed themselves with local people to disguise the fact that they were Russian soldiers. Again, just some of the moments after a pretty heavy gun battle between Slavyansk and Krematorsk. Some of the destruction here in Slavyansk. This is an artillery shell that destroyed this apartment building. And on the bottom right, this is in Mariupol during one of the first attacks on May 9th of 2014. I realize we're running a bit out of time and I wanna make sure you guys can ask questions. These were images from the shoot down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. I'm not showing you many of the other photos I took. It was a horrific sight. It was, at that point, absolutely the worst thing I've had to report on. It was really, really difficult, even for many of the pro-Russian fighters who responded to the scene, thinking that they had shot down a Ukrainian military plane. They arrived to this really gruesome scene of civilians spread across a field, burning in jet fuel, with all of their possessions sort of splayed out. It was surreal and horrific. And of course, all of the journalists for every major media descended on this tiny little nowhere village called Hrabova, which is the main crash site, although the parts of the plane and bodies fell over a large area of this part of eastern Ukraine. Afterward, Russia moved to solidify its grip on eastern Ukraine, and this was a press conference with its sort of puppet leader, Denis Pushilin, who is still, I was going to say in power. He is still a puppet leader of Russia operating in Donetsk. This was just one of the kind of bizarre press conferences that we were invited to during one of the votes that they had on their leadership. And this is just a glimpse inside of the administration building with the map of the Donetsk region, and somebody has written Russia across it in pink fluorescent pen, and they've painted over the blue and yellow Ukrainian flag up in the corner there. The war was in 2014. It eventually reached a ceasefire in early 2015. These images here. This is a woman who I came across in the immediate aftermath of a rocket attack on Krematorsk. The fighting had already ebbed and moved to a simmer at this point, but rockets were still falling down. There were still Russian attacks and assaults on cities, and this continued for many, many years. And even though, people talk about the war and the invasion, sort of, you know, thinking that it began in 2022, or that, you know, what happened in 2014 was just a clash or a conflict. You know, this was a war, and it continued on for many years. You know, 2022 really was just the next phase of Russia's war. And while I talk about this in the book, and I've talked about it in other interviews and among my colleagues and contacts, you know, something that I would underscore is that, you know, I think Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022 was largely enabled by our Western inaction over the course of, you know, 8 years between 2014 and 2022. There's a lot that, you know, the Ukrainians certainly believe could have been done to better prepare themselves to dissuade Russia from launching a full-scale invasion. They view Russia's attacks on Georgia in 2008 as sort of phase one and sort of a test run for Crimea in 2014. And 2022 as, you know, Russia really beginning its sort of like implementing its big plan. So that's why we call it the full-scale invasion rather than just the invasion, because myself, journalists covering this, Ukrainians consider 2014 to be the start of the invasion. I'll speak very briefly about this guy and I'll let you ask questions, I promise. So this is a comedian and an actor who became a war leader. You probably recognize him as having, you know, a little bit more scruff on his face, maybe like mine, and maybe not smiling like he is here. But you know, this is one of the more remarkable stories that I covered as a journalist in Ukraine. You know, I think only in Ukraine this could happen, but we did have a president here who happened to be a TV personality, didn't we? But this is how I first knew him, before we saw him in his evening addresses, you know, inspiring a nation to stand up and defend itself. He was sitting on a pink beanbag cracking jokes to me and a couple of other Ukrainian journalists back in 2019 after he had been elected, and telling me how much he liked shawarma and street food and didn't like fancy foods. We shared a couple of glasses of wine and he said, you know, I'll make sure that you're invited to my office anytime you want. He did not keep that promise. But eventually we did see each other again, and I've seen him many times since the full-scale invasion began. This is him just a few days before the full-scale invasion saying, you know, I'm not sure I believe Western intelligence. You know, Joe Biden can say, and Washington can say whatever they want, but I've seen the intelligence and we are hearing that this isn't going to happen as you say it's going to happen. You know, he cracked a joke about the popular Netflix movie that came up that came out at the time, Don't Look Up. He said, you know, we are looking up. We see everything just fine and clear from here. Please don't sow panic in our country. We have an economy to look after, so forth and so on. And then, of course, we know what would happen. These are actually a few photos from just before the full-scale invasion. This one on the left is the United States' first delivery of Javelin anti-tank missiles. The U.S. Embassy invited us out there to see them land in Kiev. And this was the last time I saw the Boryspil airport in Kiev operating. This is me just out in Avdiivka, just before the full-scale invasion with one of my reporting partners, a Ukrainian journalist. And then this is the Sea of Azov here and some of the Ukrainian patrol boats. The guy on the left was a young 20-year-old soldier whose friend had just been killed by a Russian sniper a few days before on New Year's Day, and he was digging their trenches deeper because the trenches had only come up to about forehead length, and it was enough for a Russian sniper to pick him off even from 1,000 meters away. So he was now digging the trenches as they are right now, still much deeper, so that they're able to shield themselves better. Again, we talked about the sort of mobilization of society. These are all people who have never handled a gun in their lives, turning out to learn how to use one just a few days before the full-scale invasion, using these wooden toys. And actually, what would happen was, you know, a lot of these people would go to armories and police stations on February 24th or February 25th saying, I want to defend my country, give me a gun. And they were met with the response, we don't have any more. You know, all of society that were, you know, who was willing and able and brave enough to come out and defend the country, did so very quickly, and so quickly and in such large numbers that they just ran out of guns. And I remember a friend of mine saying that his cousin, who was 19 years old, came home crying. He was so upset he couldn't get a gun and join the fight. So he said, well, screw it, I'm just going to go make Molotov cocktails. And then sat out on a friend's window in the town of Irpin and waited for the Russians to roll through so he could heave them out of the window at them. Maybe I'll stop after this and take and let you ask questions, but this was what my first day of the full-scale invasion looked like. I woke up to a missile attack just 2,000 feet away from me in Krematorsk, eastern Ukraine. And it shook the whole hotel, and it was basically all foreign correspondents in the hotel and some local workers. And it's the scene, if you've read the book yet or even just started it, the opening part of the book is these first moments when these missiles come down and everybody's kind of frantically running around. There are a bunch of German journalists in their underwear who don't know where to go, and they don't speak Russian, and I have to kind of usher them with a local hotel worker down to the bomb shelter. And this is them in the bomb shelter on the left there. And then some other journalists who had put on their gear and gone back outside to do a live stand-up for, you know, their various news programs. Some of these journalists were from the US, some of them were from various European countries. We were all trying to make sense of what was going on. There was a lot of uncertainty at that moment, a lot of concern because we were seeing things like this. Missile attacks falling all over the country. You know, this is just more, you know, people responding. There were traffic jams as people were trying to flee. So people who wanted to join the fight, like this guy here, who I spoke to through a car window as he passed, were just walking to the recruitment center because they couldn't get there quickly enough in a car. These are people who were making sandbags for barriers at checkpoints. Down below there. These are more photos of the response. This is a group of artists on the right who are making these Czech hedgehogs or these metal barriers to stop tracked armored vehicles. And then a group of a pizzeria owner and a former soldier who started this company for veterans. And then all of his veteran friends showing up to say, all right, we're you know, bringing all of our gear with us and we're ready to join the fight. What do we do? And they formed this unit that would work with the police in the early weeks of the invasion to patrol Kiev and sort of be on the lookout for saboteurs. This is what Maidan looked like in those first hours and days, you know, all blocked off. There was no traffic. The place was a ghost town. And you know, I forget exactly what the population of Seattle is, but I think it's roughly similar to Kiev. Kiev is a little bit more than 3 million, maybe upwards of 4 million people, and just imagine going out and seeing nobody. And that's what it was like in the first 24, 48 hours. Until the train started running again and people started fleeing, and then it was just a mad dash to try to get out. These are people at the train station peering through the windows to try to see if their family members made it on the train. A lot of people got separated. This is some of the Battle of Irpin, people being evacuated after this bridge was destroyed to stop the Russian advance just outside of Kiev. This is some older, more immobile people being evacuated, and these two brothers who fought and were killed just days apart being buried in western Ukraine. These are more photos back from the east. I'll jump to here, and then I promise I'll stop talking and let you ask questions. I just wanted to show you this because the photo on the left is the same market that I showed you at the beginning, where I would go and do my shopping, talk to people. I really, you know, made strong relationships and friendships with people there. I was there every day. I returned there last year, just as a rocket attack had happened, and the place was completely destroyed. And then more would happen over the course of the next several days. This is another shopping center. You can see this is a missile crater here. It was about 30 feet by 30 feet, you know, or 30 feet in diameter. This bottom photo right here is a newspaper office that I used to go to, and a friend of mine worked at, and it's all boarded up because all of the windows were shattered. And this is my street that I lived on, and the building where my friends lived, and a university that were destroyed in missile strikes. This is my photographer friend, Anatoly, taking a photo of a massive crater next to my apartment building that was destroyed. And finally, this is my old street, all blocked off. I couldn't even visit it the last time I was there because the Russians were only a couple of hundred meters down the road, and the Ukrainian soldiers advised me not to go beyond where I took this photo from. A lot of my former neighbors taking shelter in a basement in their apartment building that had just been hit. And then this last photo here was some bloodied stretchers from soldiers at the city hospital. This is what the city looked like when I arrived. On the left, I took this photo on one of my bike rides. When I left the city for the last time, a little over a year ago, this is the last photo that I took. And you can see, it might be a little bit difficult to see, but there's some smoke rising from a missile strike. We had been caught under a cluster munition attack, and all of these small little bomblets had exploded all around us and struck several homes that caught on fire. And we stopped at the top of the hill just very briefly so I could snap this photo before we took off. I'll stop there. If, you know, we can talk. I'm happy to answer all of your questions. You know, the last thing I just wanted to mention was that, you know, the cover of my book, The Blue and Yellow Flag, comes from this photo here. And it was really important to me because it was a photo that was taken back in when the war began in 2014 by a friend of mine named Max Levin. And Max and I worked together several times over the years. He was my photographer on some of the stories that I wrote. In the early weeks of Russia's full-scale invasion, he ran into some Russian soldiers who pulled him out of the car, tortured him, and killed him. And so I had met with his family and asked them if I could use this photo as a sort of way to memorialize him and to keep his photos in the public space. So the photo that you see on the cover was this photo of a bus that was used to evacuate several Ukrainian soldiers in 2014 and save dozens of lives before they could become encircled. So with that, I will take any of your questions and forgive me for my sort of, you know, meandering talk. I could keep going. I think I told you earlier, like, I might talk for 20 or 30 minutes, and I've gone well over that. But thank you for listening, and it's really nice that all of you have come here, and some of you have turned out in your Ukrainian colors and shirts as well. So thank you.